Hey, this is Richard Deitch of the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media about their job and their process. Our guest today is Paul Finebaum of ESPN Radio and the SEC Network. Talk about Paul's career, how his show became an iconic listen in the South. One of the things we talk about is his relationship with Alabama coach Nick Saban. And at SEC Media Day this year, Nick Saban and Paul Finebaum got into a very heated discussion, something we talk about on this podcast.
I actually lost all consciousness of the fact that we were on live television. I felt like we were in his office. It was a give and take because we've had those before, and this explosion happened, and it finally got to the point where he accused me of trying to push a narrative that his players should be suspended, and he finally just said, that's it. I'm not answering anything else on that.
And now, here's my conversation with Paul Finebaum. This episode of the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast with Richard Deitch is brought to you by Mack Weldon. Guys, whatever you're wearing right now, Mack Weldon is better. Mack Weldon believes in smart design, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. Mack Weldon will be the most comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, hoodies, and sweatpants that you will ever wear. And Mack Weldon wants you to be comfortable. So if you don't like your first pair, you can keep it, and they will still refund you. No questions asked. They aren't just comfortable. Mack Weldon also looks good, and it performs well, too. It's good for everyday life, good for going out to work, good for going on dates, good for working out. All of their products are naturally antimicrobial, which means they eliminate odor. How do you get Mack Weldon? Here's how you do it. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off using promo code MEDIA. That's M-E-D-I-A. Easy shopping, great customer service, good-looking, super comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, and hoodies. That's MackWeldon.com, and you get 20% off by using the promo code M-E-D-I-A. All right, and as promised, we bring in, from beautiful Charlotte, North Carolina, Paul Finebaum of the Paul Finebaum Show on ESPN Radio, as well as the simulcast on the SEC Network. Paul, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Richard, it is my pleasure. I've listened to almost all of these, and it's a real treat to be on.
It's nice of you to say. I have been on Paul's show a couple times. I very much enjoyed that experience, particularly one where he allowed me to go off on Bill Hancock, which is always fun.
That was classic.
So I want to start off with this, Paul. This is a question we ask all our guests, but I don't always start with it, but I do want to start with it for you because you have such a unique show given the content is college football, and so much of the show, I think, revolves around the Southeastern base. So I want to ask you how you prepare for each show. And then particular, I'm interested in, Paul, when college football is not in season, what your sort of thesis is on how to do a show when Alabama, Auburn, you know, whatever, Michigan, Ohio State, USC, none of those schools are playing.
Richard, I have the same routine and have had the same routine for most of my career, whether it was in the newspaper business, radio, or now. And I get up and I'm a news hound. Don't tell anyone, but I actually watch the morning news just because I'm interested in the world, and I read people laugh at me that I work with, particularly the young guys, but I read a couple of newspapers a day, the Times, the Journal, the local paper, USA Today. I'm embedded in that, and then I'm constantly keeping up with whatever is going on in our region in sports, and start to gravitate toward ESPN and Sports Center and all that. So I mean, it's a little unusual, I think. Now it's different Sunday morning. I'll get up and immediately go to college football this time of the year, preparing for a Sports Center hit or something, because I need to catch up with anything I may have missed. But I'm pretty old school when it comes to preparation, and then it just happens all day long. I don't think you get ready for a program that morning. I think you have to always be prepared, whether something happens. About eight weeks ago, I was out walking my dog with my wife, and I know this will sound terrible to young people, but I did not take my cell phone with me. It was Sunday afternoon. I'd just gotten back in town. I figured I was safe, and I walked in and my phone rang immediately, and I had four texts, and I discovered that Les Miles had been fired and they needed me in the studio in 2 seconds. So did I need to prepare for that? No. I mean, you prepare for that in what you do all the time. And to me, that's one of them. Yeah, I mean, there are certain interviews you do prepare for in a different way, but day in, day out, it's just it's always evolving.
Paul, how did being associated with ESPN change what you do versus what your show was, let's say, in 2009, 2008, et cetera?
It's interesting, Richard. Going back at that period, the show was based in Birmingham. It was on a regional network that went into certain states, Florida, Georgia, but not in any high concentration. In 2010, we went on satellite radio, which was the biggest change. So we broadened the net considerably, although it was still a very regional show. But coming here, the basic show hasn't changed all that much. It's expanded. Yes, Alabama is still a big topic. It's a big topic all day everywhere, and it's always been a big topic on our program. But you do have to wait it where everyone is noticed and gets attention, and that's probably the biggest difference.
Paul, what's interesting to me is I read recently that in an effort to expand the base of the show, ESPN Radio went to a wider national syndication for your show this summer. So two questions there. One, what does that mean? And two, is there anything you can do as the host to try to expand the tent to get, let's say, listeners interested in Maine or Ohio or Idaho, et cetera?
On the first question, this was going to happen regardless. When I was hired 3.5, almost 4 years ago, there wasn't really a structure. I was brought in a year in advance of the SEC network. And from a radio standpoint, we ended up using my old company to syndicate it because they were so familiar with the show. And I don't think at that point ESPN Radio was ready for what was a very regional show. And not long after we got off and running, it was made clear to me that ESPN would take over the show when the other contract lapsed. As far as the second question, we're on different markets. We just started this fall in Columbus, Ohio. And yeah, I mean, you think about that in the back of your mind, but you can't just go, okay, hey, we're on in Columbus, we have to talk about Ohio State football, because we have so many other markets that are larger. And not only that, we're still heard every day on the ESPN Extra channel, which is right next to ESPN on Sirius XM. So that's heard around the country. From a streaming standpoint, you can hear it on the app or anywhere else you want. So and then there's the television component, which is on nationally, heavy concentration in the South, but still you can find the show anywhere in the country or most anywhere. So I don't think any of that really affects it. And I know that's always a challenge, but we don't get too hung up on that.
Paul, this is a question that is always interesting to me to ask of print reporters who start doing television, and how being on television not only impacts them, which is interesting in itself, but impacts how others look at them. Your show is now syndicated, or simulcast, I should say, and you obviously have been on College Game Day as well as the SEC Network's pregame show on Saturdays. How much has television, which you really have done a lot of now in the last 4 or 5 years, impacted, one, what you do, and two, how you're perceived?
On the first part, it affects you, because one thing I loved about radio is you could have any number of resources in front of you. You could keep up with so many different things, and television prevents that a little bit because you do have to be cognizant of the camera. I do television every day. I do it nonstop, and it's still awkward for me to be on television. I'm a print guy who morphed into radio, and I know what I look like. But it is amazing. You mentioned College Game Day, and Richard, the first game day I did was 3 years ago in 2013, Lee Fitting sent me a note saying, hey, can you be there? And I showed up. It was in Clemson, and I went out there for my first hit. And I didn't have a lot to do on the show. I had like two hits, so it wasn't like I was like Herbie and Fowler at the time, where I was glued to the desk. So I did my hit. I got back to our compound and had nothing else to do but read Twitter. And I was just in shock. I mean, I'd never been on a forum that large. And I kept reading and reading, and every single one of them, the tweet said, "Get this guy off my television. Who put this bald monster looking character? I'm never watching ESPN." And it, I had to finally, after 15 minutes, say to myself, "Oh, quit looking at this stuff. You can't let that affect you." And I still get that, whether I'm on game day, whether I'm on SportsCenter, and you just have to laugh about it. I don't let Twitter or critics or anyone else dictate my life. I know what I'm doing, or think I do. But I think when you're a non-television looking personality, which I clearly am, you're going to get that reaction, particularly from young people who have no earthly idea what they're watching.
That's interesting you say that, because there's a lot of students, I'm sure, who listen to this podcast, and both broadcast and print, and there are going to be people who want to go on television who are not Johnny Depp or George Clooney or television ready. So you now actually, I feel like, can offer some perspective on what you think works. There's a guy who I work with at Time Inc., the guy who basically runs the entire company's video, won an Emmy recently. I'll give him a shout. His name is Ian Orifice, who said, and this is where it's very different, in my opinion, Paul, from men and women. This is where sexism comes in. But he said that if you're a man, you are judged basically in the first, he believes, in the first 5 seconds on your appearance on video, and then they start listening to your content. So if you in your head can get past your own idiosyncrasies or your own self-doubts and just focus on the content, you're fine. He said it's different, he believed, for women, because he believes particularly men judge women too often on how they look, and it's a much different ballgame, particularly in sports. So that's a long way of opening this question up to you, Paul, that have you been able to glean some things in terms of doing these television hits that you can pass on to younger people who are understandably worried about, how do I look? How do I dress? Are all these people going to judge me based on aesthetics as opposed to my content?
Richard, I try to listen. I'm considerably older than a lot of the young people on television. So I try to minimize the negatives. And I dress fairly conservatively. I usually am dressed. A lot of times, I was on Mike and Mike earlier today, and those guys are casual, but that's who they are. I feel like I'm representing something else, so I usually wear a jacket and a tie. But I try not to be crazy, because I don't want someone to look at television and go, "What is this guy wearing?" So I keep fairly buttoned down in that regard. And I think once you do that, people are going to pay less attention. And I agree with you, what you said about male versus female. And Lee Fitting, someone I have great admiration for, told me when I first went to work with him on game day, is don't waste time. Get your point across as quickly and as coherently as possible, which is difficult for a writer to do. And that was a great bit of advice. So when someone asks a question, give the answer. Don't equivocate. Don't give the Gettysburg Address or something longer. I think those are important things. But I think, and I'll speak for males, because I'm certainly not qualified to speak about females. But I think, look professional. And I look up at television sometimes, whether it's CNN or ESPN or other networks. I'm like going, what are these people thinking? There are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people watching. Be a grown-up and look the part.
I want to ask you a number of questions on this, because when I put out on Twitter that you were going to be on, there were a lot of questions that sort of revolved within this kind of content or questioning. So let me first start this off with, in your opinion, what is the line between provocateur and trolling when it comes to sports opinion?
Richard, there is a line, and I will plead guilty to having crossed it, and anyone who claims that they haven't is probably not being truthful, but I have a fairly strong journalism background, which helps me, I think, try to weed out right and wrong. And I being a provocateur, in my mind, means trying to get people to think. Trolling is just making an outrageous statement just to cause a reaction. And I I try not to do that. And I say try because you do a four-hour show every day, you're on live television, and you are going to say things that sometimes don't come out the right way. I know that sounds like I'm making an excuse here, but it does happen, and I've been guilty of it. But I try not to, because at the end of the day, you have to have a modicum of self-worth and self-respect, and I try very hard not to just make outrageous statements to make them, because I don't feel like I need to, and therefore I try not to.
Some of the questions that were asked from some readers were, and again, sort of the same thing along the lines of what I just asked you. How many of Paul Feinbaum's opinions are genuine versus calculated for views, clicks, or drama? How would you respond to that?
I would say all of them. I don't, and maybe this comes with a little bit of age or maturity or feeling comfortable in what I'm doing, but I don't feel like I just need to say something to say it. Now, sometimes the questions force that. You go through the drill at any network, and you're going to get questions that prompt answers that may seem more tilted toward outrage. I made a statement the other day. I was on College Game Day talking about Baylor, and I said they should cancel the season because of what had happened. Is that realistic? No. But I felt like it needed to be said. So I said it. Was that trolling? I don't think it was. I think I was talking about one of the worst and most outrageous situations I've ever witnessed in college football. And by making a strong statement, it, in my mind, forced some people to at least think about it. I know I'm walking into a buzzsaw here by asking what specifically is your definition, but I try not to, although I know I've done it. So, is that like being partially pregnant? No, it just means that I'm being honest about it. But day in, day out, I don't roll out of bed and say, okay, how am I going to tweak the Michigan fan or the Ohio State fan or the Auburn fan or the Alabama fan?
Paul, a couple times, again, on social media, when some of these questions for you came in, there were some listeners who compared you to Skip Bayless. Are you pleased by that, offended by that, or do you think the premise of that is just is incorrect, and why?
Well, let me say this, and I've heard you talk about Skip, and I respect you as a journalist and in your opinions. I grew up admiring Skip. I went to him when I was a young reporter. I walked over to him at a game and introduced myself because he was a role model for a lot of young people that came in the next wave. As far as what he's done, I don't say I watch and listen to everything he says, and I know I've read all of your criticism of him, but I'm not trying to be Skip Bayless. I'm very content with what I'm doing, and I'm not trying to be anything else.
Paul, well, it's been a great interview after your compliment of Skip Bayless. Thanks very much, Dick.
Richard, listen, I at one time in my career, I'll just, not to obfuscate here, but I did a little media criticism for my local newspaper, and sports media, and it was something I really gave some thought to doing long term if I had stayed true and hard in the newspaper business. So I get where you're coming from. I may not agree with it totally. I don't think the audience really wants to hear us debate Skip.
No kidding.
But I do. I'm not ashamed to say that I have admired his career and his accomplishments.
Well, I appreciate your honesty there, and that's fine. I was only joking. I actually prefer. I always like the phrase, or not the phrase, but I consider myself a writer who covers sports media as opposed to a media critic. I understand people will call me a
no,
critic.
No, I understand,
and that's fine. But it's always interesting to me. I try not to correct people. Only because how one perceives it is their own subjective opinion. So that's always interesting. I will say Colin Cowherd, I think, famously once said, if I remember hearing him on the radio, that the third dumbest person at a newspaper is a sports media writer, which I always loved, or something to that effect.
Well, you know, I know differently because I know you, and I know Richard, who I just find irony leaving the Times to go write obits.
Right, yeah. They killed him.
I mean, I'm fascinated by the field because I'm in it now on the other side, and I still think of things as the old newspaper guy, and what would I say, and what would offend me, and yeah, I'm not easily offended, and yeah, I mean, I watch a lot of new TV and listen to radio, and I know when people are just saying things to say them, and Skip doesn't need me to explain it, nor to Stephen A. or anyone else, but I get what you're doing, and I know you well enough to know that you're not just saying it to say it. You truly believe it.
Yeah, and actually, and I've always been consistent in this, and it's very true. The thing that I enjoy most about covering or writing sports media is when I can write about people who are behind the scenes who you've never heard of. Now, they're not going to come close to getting the traffic of a Bill Simmons or something like that, there's no bullshit here. That is truly my favorite thing, when you can, like, contact the camera person who shot – like the pylon camera, which is the greatest shot of a particular NFL game, or the people, who are like the college kid or something, like who's a spotter for Vern Lundquist. Like, that interests me 1,000 times more. But the realities of the market is, you know, you have to write about the Bill Simmonses. And
sure.
The thing where the business sort of screwed up, in my opinion, and where places like Deadspin really were ahead of the curve is, somebody like Joe, and Paul, I know you agree with me on this because you're in the business, but, you know, someone like Joe Buck or Chris Berman or Jim Nantz or James Brown, these are people that millions of people see on their television every day. They're more well-known than the second or third starter for most Major League Baseball teams. People consume them. They have an opinion about them. So the fact that a publication would not want to cover them as a beat always struck me as so odd, when you give so much attention to sports. Because if you covered sports media in the same way, certainly those of us at Sports Illustrated and every blog has found, the traffic is there. People are very interested in this business. And I'm sure you, Paul, as you've gone more on television, are probably maybe even sometimes struck by the fact that how many people care about what you say on television.
I am, to this day, Richard, surprised when someone comes up to me at an airport or wherever I am and wants to talk to me. And I think that's because, as a newspaper person, I knew things were changing. I was working on an investigative piece many, many years ago, and I snuck into a high school thinking that I could snoop around and get my story. And the next thing I heard, everyone had recognized me, and I knew then I had to go a different route. But I don't expect people to know me. I really don't. And maybe that's naive on my part. I'm with Tim Tebow every weekend, and I see the hullabaloo that goes with him, and I've seen it with Kirk and others, but I don't view myself as a mainline matinee star that people want to meet and shake hands with. So I think my perspective is always a little bit different, but I do agree with your point about the people behind the scenes. And I knew that as a newspaper person. I never felt like I was much of a writer, and thank goodness I had editors that could clean up the mess. And it's the same way on television.
Paul, one of the things I want to ask you about, given the fact that you have so many callers who are from the Southeast, and I've listened to your show a little bit over the last couple of days, knowing that I was going to have you on, but I did not listen in the days leading up as much to the election and the day after or the 2 days after the election. Apologies to you. I was pretty much consumed with cable news and the Washington Post and other places, and living in Manhattan here. I'm trying to make sure that, you know, most of my fellow citizens and, you know, aren't jumping into the river at this point, but I think we'll be okay. But my question for you is, having talked to so many people in Alabama, in North Carolina, Mississippi, Louisiana, one, how much election stuff did you do? And two, and this is one of the questions I'm so fascinated by, Paul, did you have any indication before the result that there was this kind of popularity for Donald Trump, that maybe people who are part of the media establishment in D.C. and in New York City and in Los Angeles totally missed?
I was surprised by the outcome, but that's because I watch a lot of the same networks that you do and read some of the same things. But I will tell you, in talking to people day in, day out, I was not surprised at all. I know that sounds a little bit contradictory, but our audience in the deepest part of the South obviously went for Trump, as you know.
Right.
And I heard it from the day he announced, from the moment he walked down the staircase at Trump Tower, that there was a real passion for that. And as someone who loves politics, Richard, and who consumed as much of it as I could in the months, if not the years, leading up to November 8th, it was not a total shock, because he connected in a way that I've rarely seen anyone connect. And I learned from this, because when I watch the networks, I'm watching the content, but I'm also watching how people talk, because as a primer for my own career, And I felt like a lot of people just completely and totally missed the obvious because there was such biases built in. And I think it is a lesson. I try to avoid politics. Used to get into it much more, but because there's no middle ground, we have done a nice job of avoiding it even after the election, and that's something that I think is the path we will take. Funny, I was on the college football playoff selection show on the Tuesday of the election, and I was sitting there waiting to go on with Reese Davis after the chairman of the committee was speaking. I mean, here I am. It's a pretty major show for ESPN. But I literally had one eye on CNN, seeing like watching which state Wolf Blitzer was about to call. So that was one of the most distracting nights I've ever had, because I cared, I'll admit this, far more about what was going on in the election than what the College Football Playoff Committee was about to say.
I can imagine. A couple things there, because again, I think your callers provide sort of an interesting base. I was never surprised at the dislike and in some cases hatred for Hillary Clinton. None of that surprised me. I think if you were an educated reader, you saw that. Where I think a lot of people did miss, though, is either a passion for Trump, a passion for what they believe Trump stood for, et cetera. So in the calls, Paul, that you got on the Wednesday and Thursday, and I want to eventually ask you about your callers because they're some of the more fascinating people in the business, Phyllis and Jim, Iman, et cetera. But did you – how do I sort of phrase this? In New York, Paul, if you listen to certain stations, including sports stations, but certainly more news stations, there were people calling up almost crying at times, saying to the fact that I can't believe this, the world is ending, I never saw this coming. I wonder, even in a sports context – did you get calls basically either celebratory or, hey, I knew this was going to happen in the same way I knew Alabama was going to roll LSU? It's just interesting to me because your base would not be something that I would have heard living here in New York the next day.
Richard, I heard some relief, frankly, and some attacks on the media, which didn't totally surprise me. Let me say I don't claim to know Donald Trump very well. I did have dinner with him many years ago in a small group, and that's all it took for me to understand him. And he's a quick study. There's no when you sit around for 3 hours with Donald Trump, and actually saw him the next day too and interviewed him. This was when I was covering the USFL and he owned the Generals. There was never a mystery after that he would do something large. But back to the question about the reaction, we let a little bit of it on. We tried to temper it, but we didn't get the sad faces and the tears that I saw at the Javits Center. We got more of the reaction that was at his election celebration. And I understand that. I try very hard to keep my political opinions off the show. I don't share them. I have basic political views, but they have moved. I grew up, my parents and my sister, all three of my mother, father, and sister were all born in New York. I'm the only Southerner in the family, so I've been exposed to that perspective for my entire life, or at least as long as my parents lived.
All right, Paul, one of the things I want to get to now is, and I appreciate you asking that because, you know, there's a lot of broadcasters who don't want to, and understandably so, don't want to talk politics at all. You're just in a unique position because of where your show is and where it's based. But I want to ask you a couple questions about the SEC and the SEC network. And first off, let's start with Tebow before I get to Saban. When Tim was hired at the SEC Network, for the SEC Network, for ESPN, I'll be very honest. My thought before he was on the air was, nice guy, totally respect his humanitarianism, and I think he walks his walk, which I respected. I thought he'd be the most vanilla broadcaster in the history of college football, given some of the interviews I had seen with him, given the fact that I had sat on in some interviews with him. He totally surprised me, Paul. He is an excellent analyst. Initially, when he did some game work, it was very clear he had both done the preparation as well as had the, I think, unique ability to explain things in a layperson's term, which is not very easy to do. And so I have found him, and I realize now he's pursuing his baseball career, but I found him to be so much better than I expected and someone who really took the job seriously. You sat next to him or sit next to him at times, so you see him up close. And I wonder just what your sense of him has been as a fledgling broadcaster, because he blew away my expectations by fivefold.
Richard, I think the first year, and this is now year three, you knew he would be good. You didn't know how good. And the Tebow that I saw the very first day versus the one I was with last Saturday is literally night and day. And as he has grown in that role, he is much more comfortable giving opinions, very strong opinions. And I think if he wanted to be, he could be just a superb college football analyst. I don't know if that's what he wants because of what he's doing in baseball. But what he's done this year, I think, is the most remarkable in the fact that he's literally flying in late Thursday night, early Friday morning from Arizona and trying to catch up. And you wouldn't know it. You wouldn't know that he's playing baseball all week. But I have gotten to know him and become very close friends with him, and he is exactly what you see. He is a giving person. He genuinely cares. He's one of the most remarkable people I've ever been around. And this is not some Bristol public relations statement. I mean, this is real. This is the guy that I see, and he has to deal with so much. I mean, he is relatable to so many people and affects so many people. But as a college football analyst, he's fantastic.
The second guy I want to ask you about, and this is a guy who I honestly think has the kind of ceiling where he could one day, if he wanted to, replace Herb Street for ESPN ABC, and that's Greg McElroy. Greg McElroy is probably the best, or was the best, under 25 college football analyst I've ever heard when he first started doing this. If he wasn't still playing, I'm trying to remember when he first jumped on ESPN. He was very, very close or 1 year out. But that is a guy, Paul, and I know he's been on your show many times. That guy to me has an unlimited ceiling. He is the, I'm trying to sort of, I don't usually deal in hyperbole, but whatever his age is, he is the best under 26 or under 27 college football analyst, I believe, in the country. You work with him, you're probably a little biased in that sense. But can you give my listeners just a sense of what, in your opinion, makes this guy so good? Because he is an exceptional, in my opinion, analyst for someone that young.
Well, let's start with the fact that he was nominated and was a Rhodes Scholar finalist. You can be smart and not be good. He is both. And we traveled together last year. And when Greg was with the Jets, he was a weekly guest on our show. And so I've known him from a broadcasting standpoint for some time. He is growing into exactly what you said there. I love the fact that he's so smart, and you can interpret that any way you want, but that's not something you always get when you're dealing with college football. And he's able to analyze, he's able to articulate, and he is the most prepared person I have ever been around, almost to a point where we used to joke with him last year, Greg, okay, we got it. I mean, but I think the sky is the limit. I don't think he's going to be a college football broadcaster for that long, because I think I really believe the pull of politics is going to get to him. When I was in Alabama, I had the head of the Republican Party called me once and said, can you hook me up with Greg McElroy? We want to see about grooming him to be the next governor or senator or whatever. And I think at some point he is going to grow out of this.
I would not be surprised, given obviously his sort of academic background, and he is superbly bright. But that he struck, it's a guy who I remember from day one when he came on. I think he might have been a senior at the time for Alabama and popped on to ESPN's BCS coverage. But I remember just sort of taking a mental note to myself going, that guy, if this is what this guy wants, there's just sort of something about him. The same way I felt about Chris Archer, who the Tampa Bay Rays pitcher, when he was on ESPN's postseason broadcast. It just, you just sort of like shake your head like, wow, this guy just has it. In terms of Nick Saban, Paul, you and Nick Saban made some sort of national noise with a interaction that you had during SEC Media Day. Saban is someone you've known, Paul, for a long time. You've had your back and forths with him. I think you guys have a long-time relationship. He likes you, or at least can deal with you enough to appear with you or on your show. But from your perspective, what was that like? We don't often see, I don't know how I phrase this, we don't often see heated interactions with a commentator and a coach on air when we as viewers can sort of see that and then make our own judgment. And that is what happened with you and Nick What was it like from your perspective, both during it and in the aftermath?
Fascinating. And I've known him since he was at LSU, and since he arrived at Alabama, we've had a very close relationship. In his first couple of years, would call me often for advice on things. Don't think he ever took it, but he called. Here we are. We're at SEC Media Days, a live interview. His star left tackle, Cam Robinson, had been arrested in Louisiana on, I think it was a gun and drug charge. And Saban had been in the big room. Richard, just to set it up, at SEC Media Days, and something you really do need to see one day, there's a print room where all the print guys are in there and the women. And Saban was not asked the question about this.
Wow.
Now, what I didn't understand at the time is earlier he had met with a group of writers in a suite. He always does this. I was doing something else, so I wasn't up there. And it came up there, but it didn't come up, and we had live coverage of the print room. So I'm thinking, we have to ask him this question. So Dari Noka was the first one, the host. He asked it, and Saban gave a noncommittal answer. And I just questioned him again, and I can't remember the exact give and take, and I challenged him, and he came at me, and I challenged him again, and it was an explosion. Now, why did it happen? Some people have said, you set out to do it. I did not. What happened was I was so familiar with Coach Saban. I had spent last summer, I did an OTL piece on him where I was with him two or three times, I should say, on a plane, in his office. So, I mean, we have a very good familiarity. And if this is even possible, but I'm going to say it with a straight face, I actually lost all sight of the fact that, or consciousness of the fact that we were on live television. I felt like we were in his office. It was a give and take because we've had those before. And this explosion happened. And it finally got to the point where he just, he accused me of trying to push a narrative that his players should be suspended. And he finally just said, that's it. I'm not answering anything else on that. And that was on the third give and take. And at that point, I just deferred. There were two other people on the panel. I think McElroy and Marcus Spears were also there. I walked. What was interesting is we went off the air and it continued. he just came right back after me, like, and using some pretty choice words, like, how could you ask me that? Now, what he didn't understand or realize is there were cameras around, print reporters were around, and they were videotaping this, and a lot of people heard it. And I bumped into him about 30 minutes later. I was walking to the set to do SportsCenter or College Football Live, and he came in after me again. Now, what happened after that was interesting. He got in his car, and I think his PR guy started realizing what an explosion had occurred. It was obviously all over Twitter. He called me about an hour later to apologize, and yeah, I was not all that concerned about it. And we actually saw each other a couple of days later in Bristol when he came through there. And I, as far as I'm concerned, it was forgotten about very quickly. Although a lot of people were shocked by it, shocked that I would ask him the questions, and some were shocked that he would respond that way. But most were shocked that I would dare to challenge Coach Saban on anything.
Is that what the sort of the takeaway for you was, Paul, that like, and again, listen, Nick Saban is the most successful college football coach of the number one team in the country and the country's biggest college football dynasty. But, and again, you know this from sort of being once based in Birmingham and now in Charlotte, but did it give you more of an indication of just how in certain pockets, the idea that, you know, your coach can be questioned by either a journalist or a commentator is just verboten? Because that's, you know, we see that certainly today in the larger sphere of politics. But that, if I'm reading you right, maybe even you, having been on this journey for 20, 30 years, maybe we're even surprised that some who would sort of make it like, how dare you question Coach Saban about his discipline? In the same way I saw very recently, Paul, in the last couple of days, of some Alabama fans saying, how dare you question Coach Saban saying he wasn't paying attention to the election and was only focused on football?
Exactly, Richard. And you know, I can put up with a lot, but I struggled to put up with hypocrisy. And I felt like he was being hypocritical on the election issue, frankly, and also in the setting in at SEC Media Days, because I was asking what I thought was a legitimate question that had not been asked and needed to be asked, and he just did not like it. And he actually went in on the police, saying that they were
Baton Rouge police or LSU police were. Am I correct about this sort of intentionally targeting his players because they were Alabama?
Exactly.
Right.
And I don't sit around and maybe it's because I've covered that beat. I know how difficult it is. I've had trouble with coaches before. I was Ray Perkins, who coached at the Giants. He said that he would not be in the same room with me, and I went to one of his press conferences after a game, and he walked out. So, I mean, but I can't let that affect me, and I'm not doing anything other than my job. And I realize who he is. I know him well. But I felt like that question needed to be asked, and I felt like it needed to be followed up. And I felt like he was giving me a disingenuous answer or an agenda-based answer. And I've done that with other people. And it wasn't for any other reason than I felt like the audience was entitled to an answer.
I appreciate you answering that. You know, it's interesting. On the election, I am one who believes Nick Saban can feel anything he wants about the election. He can vote or not vote. That's his choice to me as an American. The only thing that sort of was very suspect to me was it was hard for me to believe that Nick Saban was not aware that Tuesday was election day. I understand the process, and I respect Saban's sort of full commitment to football. But in 2016, it seems almost inconceivable with every form of media that exists that you can live in a bubble that you would not know that day is election day. And that's where, you know, whether it's Belichick who does it or Saban that does it, it does get a little, what's my politically correct phrase here, frustrating to hear that kind of stuff. I'd rather even somebody just be honest and say, like, you know, I'm not a political guy. This stuff doesn't concern me. I got a job to do at Alabama, as opposed to, like, I didn't know it was election day. I feel like that's insulting my intelligence as a human being.
And that's,
you know,
how I felt, and I caught a lot of flack from the audience. But, I mean, all he had to say was, like, I'm trying to win a football game.
Right, exactly.
But he went on to make a speech about it. Because I think he is so concerned. And I think I pointed out later that his best friend is a Democratic senator from West Virginia, Joe Manchin. And I'm not insinuating he's a Republican or Democrat, because I have no idea. And it doesn't matter. But it sent the wrong message. And I think sometimes Saban tends to overdo things and over-explain. And some of that comes from having an adoring audience and an adoring press around him.
All right, let's finish up on this, Paul. Your callers there have been other sports talk shows that have had famous callers, and in the entertainment sphere, Howard Stern's callers, which are called the Whack Pack. I mean, essentially, ingeniously used what we now would call today as user content, but he geniusly used his callers as characters on his show for decades, which was genius, and I think almost ahead of the time. Your callers on your show, whether it's Jim from Tuscaloosa, where is Phyllis from? Mulga?
She's from right outside of Birmingham. Mulga.
Right outside of Birmingham. Where's I-Man from? I should know this.
He's from Montgomery.
Okay, I-Man's from Montgomery. So those are three, and there obviously are many others. But your show became, I think, a bit of a cultural phenomenon away from the South because of these callers. And I think, you know, I'll speak as a Northerner here. I would listen to these guys, and I was like, this is like the greatest thing I've ever heard. I mean, I could literally listen to, like, I could listen to 3 hours of Phyllis. I'm not lying to you, Paul. And I would be entertained literally for those whole 3 hours because I think she's fascinating. In the same way, I find a lot of Howard Stern's callers fascinating. So when did this, for those who don't know, when did this first start? And secondly, how do you see them in the sort of overall thesis of your show?
I think the callers are the stars. And I've always felt like that. And some of that comes from being in Birmingham, where you're not going to get the A-list guests like we can now, being an ESPN platform. And it just slowly evolved, and we began to bring callers together at Christmas or at various times of the year, and we really got to know these people, and it just grew. And Richard, I think it's the reason I am where I am right now, as a result of the callers, as a result of Harvey Updike calling in 2011 and admitting that he had poisoned the tumors, trees. You saw a couple of things happen. You saw a 30 for 30, Roll Tide, War Eagle, which led to something else that was the most significant moment of my career, and that was when the New Yorker magazine in 2012 did about a 5,000 or 6,000 word profile of me. That led to countless other situations, which ultimately led to me being here. So I have an average voice. I look like a sports writer on television, but what separated me, I think, from others was the fandom and the callers. And I think that's exactly what happened and what led to me being at this particular place at this particular time.
Paul, do you ever interact with the callers outside of the show?
I do. Jim from Tuscaloosa used to call me all the time. He had my cell phone. He dared me on giving him the number, and I did. And he was the first person that I knew the day Trump announced, not to go back to the politics. He called me and started telling me about what motivated him toward Trump, and I began listening to him. And I see I don't see them as often now because I live in North Carolina, but I still run into them when I travel the SEC every weekend, and I feel like I have a relationship with them. And now they're people. It's become, because of social media, the so-called Feinbaum callers are now a family. They interact with each other, Facebook, Twitter, you name it. They get together at games. This year at SEC Media Days, about 10 of them came together, and we had them by the show, and they all went out to dinner. And that to me is one of the most satisfying parts of this job. And I wasn't sure, and I remember talking to you about this right after I was hired by ESPN, whether we would be able to continue this because of the enormity of the SEC network and where I worked. But quite frankly, not much has changed.
Paul, I want to finish up on this. This is sort of something that really fascinates me. I just spent the weekend with Vern Lundquist in Baton Rouge for the LSU-Alabama game. It was my first SEC game I ever saw. It was incredible, and I'm so glad I did it. But the thing about Lundquist and his career, which is fascinating, and people now know him as the voice of the SEC and Uncle Vern, et cetera, but Vern Lundquist did not make it to a network full-time until he was 42. He did not lead a package on his own until 2000 with the SEC network. He was always a number two or a number three guy and a network. He found his most fame or his biggest job very late in his life. I think he's 75 or 6 now. You, while having a very popular regional show, did not find national, if you want to call it fame or national sort of a national job until later in your professional life. And you mentioned the New Yorker piece that found you late. You now, just because I want to bust on him, you have a very powerful agent, Paul, at CAA, Nick Kahn, the Kaiser Sose of the business. So the larger point is, I'm saying, is you found this kind of success late in your life, professional life, I should say, as Vern did. And that's interesting to me. And I wonder, upon reflection of that, how do you see it? Because you're not somebody who was 22 hired by ESPN, you know, Sam Ponder or someone like that. You lived before you had this sort of national existence. And Vern and I have talked about this a lot, and I find that interesting. And you are very similar to him. So I wonder how you see it.
I'll tell you a story. In 2012, my contract was coming to an end. It was about 6 months out. And I asked a friend, who was a very prominent person in the community. I said, I really need some help. And he said, I think you need to hire an agent. And I'd had a local attorney who had been very good. And it took 6 weeks to set up a meeting, Richard, with a major agent in New York. SiriusXM was interested in hiring me at the time when the contract ended. And I felt like I needed representation. So it took 6 weeks. I flew to New York. Went to see him. I'll leave his name out of it, but his name would be recognizable. And I walked in, and he looked at me and said, so what do you want? I go, well, I hope to talk to SiriusXM as soon as my – he said, SiriusXM's not going to hire you. I go, okay. This was like 30 seconds into the meeting. He said, well, what else are you thinking about? I said, well, but for a guy who makes a living talking, I was speechless. I said – ESPN is something that he said, ESPN is not hiring you. And now, Richard, we're about 2 minutes into the meeting, and I don't know if he obviously did this as a favor. I'm not sure I can make 5 minutes. And I've flown to New York, and finally, someone else was in the meeting, so maybe we could get him some sideline work on some midweek college packages. I said, no, I'm not here to get sideline work. I'm here. And anyway, I walked out of the meeting, Richard, and this was 4 years ago, and I called my wife, and I had been thinking about broadening the show nationally for some time. And I called her and I said, you know what, I'm going to spend the rest of my life in Birmingham. And she said, well, maybe that's not so bad. I know you were dreaming bigger things, but it's not going to work out. And I found myself walking around Central Park. The meeting was right off of Central Park. I had another meeting scheduled for about 30 minutes later, before I had to go back to LaGuardia. And I mean, I was literally talking to myself like a bum in Central Park, saying, well, maybe it's okay. It was like one of the most amazing moments of my career, where I finally realized it was going to end in Birmingham and I was okay with it. I had a meeting at the Ritz-Carlton right off Central Park South with a blogger. He had sent me an email. Can you meet? And I didn't think it was that big a deal. So we sat there, and he was a blogger with the New Yorker magazine. And I said, well, what are you thinking about? He said, well, we're thinking. And he kind of said something, and I didn't really hear it. And I said, what did you say? He said, I've been talking to David Remnick, for those who don't know, is the editor of the New Yorker. And he feels like we needed to do a college football profile. We haven't done one in about 10 years, and he wants to do one with on you. We want to do one on you. And I'm like, going, are you? And all of a sudden, that started happening. And when I got back, I called Joe Tessitore, who was a good friend. I'd gotten to know him through Roll Tide War Eagle. And I said, Joe, I had this rather bizarre meeting with this agent. He said, let me hook you up with Nick Cott. And a postscript, the agent actually that blew me off actually called me back a week later and offered to represent me once he started making a few calls. But I was not going back there. And I met Nick Cott a couple of days later. He wanted to fly in, but I didn't. I said, I don't trust agents. So we met halfway at a terrible Mexican restaurant at DFW. And I said, Nick, I didn't know anything about Nick. I mean, he was big, but he wasn't as big as he is now. And he laid out a plan. He said, I think ESPN would be interested in you. I think this could happen. I think that could happen. He literally, he had a blueprint for what has happened over these next 3 to 4 years. So I'm just simply saying, you never know where a window will open. I'm not trying to tell everyone that you can go down this path, but in the course of 30 minutes, my career was over. And then another door was open because of that New Yorker article. And the day the New Yorker article came out, Richard, in December of 2012, I had a call the next day from a literary agent who ended up leading me toward a book deal with HarperCollins. The ESPN train, Nick was already had already communicated with John Skipper, and then John read the John had heard my name, but he wasn't sure where he heard my name. And then he read the New Yorker article, and I think you know the rest of the story. So yeah, I mean, I've just passed into my 60s. I don't know where it's going. I have no earthly idea, but people like Vern, Charlie Rose, guys who have always been successful but are more successful in their 70s than they've ever been, are certainly inspirations. I mean, I never thought I would work that long, but right now, no door is closed. I feel like my career has certainly been restarted, and I'm fortunate for every day I walk into every time I do a hit for SportsCenter or Game Day or SEC Nation or whatever I do. My eyes are wide open. They're doe-eyed like a teenager going out on his first date. Some people can be cynical, but because of what I've gone through and because of how I thought it was over, and now suddenly within a span of a couple of months it wasn't. I just look at every day and really can't believe it.
I appreciate you sharing that story. The writer is Reeves Winneman, and he is still at the New Yorker. And if you have not read that piece, I I absolutely recommend it. And it is correct, Paul. That piece changed your life. There's no way around that. It put you into, I think, just a different ecosystem, and it got people reading about you who never would have read before. And John Skipper, interestingly enough, is one of those guys with his master's degree, I think, in literature or somewhere it is at Columbia. He is the type of guy who probably reads The New Yorker and saw that. So it's amazing how one's career, if they get lucky, can change in a dime.
Well, no, it's funny, Richard. I'll never forget telling my wife about it, because the story went on for months. Reeves came down and he went back, and it was an election year. The story was supposed to come out the first weekend of November. It was the 2012 election, and they put it off. And I'm like, and then Alabama lost a game, and I'm thinking, this thing is never going to see the light of day. I mean, you know the drill. And my wife kept saying, why are you so obsessed about this article? And I'm saying, well, she said, I don't know anybody that reads The New Yorker. I said, well, I felt comfortable that a few people might, that mattered. And it you know, for a guy that grew up in print journalism, it was also a reminder that it does matter. The written word really is important. And no, without that, and by the way, I'm not saying my life was over, because I would still be doing a local show in Birmingham. I was happy doing it. And that day in Central Park, I had come to grips with it. But this has just truly been an amazing journey the last 4 years.
The Paul Feinbaum Show, the syndicated Paul Feinbaum Show, airs on ESPN Radio. It's also simulcast on the SEC Network. Paul is part of SEC Nation on the SEC Network. You see him on ESPN as well. Paul, is there any other radio outlet that I'm missing? Like, are you on Sirius right now, or iHeart Radio or something? Feel free to plug it.
Yeah, I mean, no, I mean, I think you covered it pretty well. If you want to hear the show, you can find it.
Either via stream or on terrestrial radio. Well, listen, Paul, I appreciate the time that you've given me. I think you have, your career is very interesting to me, at least. And your show just, I think, is, especially having now gone to Baton Rouge to see LSU and Alabama, I've always known about the popularity of the SEC, but that changed it for me forever, because I could see it with my own eyes. And now I understand even at least a little bit. I don't pretend to be some kind of expert, but I now understand a lot more, having seen it with my own eyes, the passion of the people who call you. So this is an interview I've wanted to do for a long time, and I appreciate you coming on to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Well, as a devoted listener of the podcast, it has been an honor and a privilege and a great pleasure. Richard, thank you for having me.
All right, back in the studio to wrap up, joined by my producer, Lou Pellegrino. I appreciate Paul Feinbaum as a guest. That was really interesting. Just one sort of quick note for me. A couple weeks ago, as I mentioned, I went to Baton Rouge to do a story on Vern Lundquist in his last year as the voice of SEC football. And that was the first SEC game I had ever seen. Last year on Twitter, I asked people who follow me, like, what's the one game I should see if I could ever get to an SEC game? Most people suggested Alabama-LSU or Alabama-Auburn or maybe going to the Grove. But essentially, most of the suggestions had to do with Alabama. So for me to get a sense of what that was like, the access I got afforded put me on the field prior to the game. Tiger Stadium, it's inconceivable to explain how loud it is when the LSU team comes on the field. I mean, it's like the stadium shook. It was just unreal. And got to tailgate with some LSU fans, which was so much fun, and their hospitality was incredible, and they were giving us Cajun food. But the one thing that sort of just stays with me is, as a New Yorker, you can watch SEC football and you can understand sort of that it's popular, but until you see it with your eyes, you can't really understand it. And to be able to look up at that stadium and to see 100,000 people dressed in purple losing their mind, you understand why a 17- or 18-year-old in the South wants to go to LSU or Alabama or Auburn or Ole Miss, because it must be like the most exciting thing ever. As I bring in Lou Pellegrino, Lou, both of us are from New York, and that is, you know, maybe for us, that's the experience of going to Shea Stadium or Citi Field or Yankee Stadium. But I have to be honest with you, that finally gave me a sense of why people think of SEC football there as religion, because that the fervor and, I don't want to say craziness, but zeal that these people had for that team and that program. And by the way, it's a little dangerous too, given how much power that gives administrators and coaches, and you could see why a lot of bad shit happens. But if nothing else, it was eye-opening to me. Other than European soccer, I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, college football fans are maybe the most rabid fans out there. I mean, you look at your guest's show, where you see the SEC fans square off against each other, and Alabama's going to win, no, Auburn's going to win, or LSU's going to, and they all start screaming and yelling at each other, and it's great theater. But yeah, you're right. Being from New York, you don't get that oomph because Rutgers is up here, Army's up here, and that's not knocking Army. I'm just saying their football program has not been, you know, a top
echelon. It's not 1944.
This isn't Fordham University with, you know, Vince Lombardi and the four, what was it, the seven blocks of granite, and they're winning games 6-3. But there's something about college football, and I've only been to one college football game in my life.
Is that right?
It was a Giant Stadium. It was when they used to have the kickoff classic. And I saw Penn State against USC, and USC had Carson Palmer. This was Carson Palmer years ago. And this was a neutral site. So, of course, all the Penn State fans drive up, and you see all the blue and white. And this is when Penn State was Penn State, not what we see now and what Penn State has gone through. But it was just so cool, that tailgating, that atmosphere, fans of each team coming up to each other, hey, good luck, hey, good luck, you know, because they knew this is something special, this is something great. But when you go to the SEC, and you just see the hatred and the anger and the want to just pulverize your opponent. My God, I want to go to an SEC game. I want to go see the Volunteers play because I want to see the checkerboard end zone. I want to go see LSU because, like you said, the purple and gold and the Go Tigers. And then why wouldn't you want to go see Alabama play Auburn in the Iron Bowl? You know, I've had a friend who graduated from Alabama, and he talks about being at those games while he was a, you know, freshman, sophomore, junior, senior. And he said it was just like nothing he'd ever experienced before. And he's from Cleveland, so he doesn't have much to go on with the Cleveland Browns, you know. So
it was amazing. I mean, I lived in Ann Arbor for a year, so I've been to Michigan, the Big House, many times. It was just different. It was bigger, felt bigger, even though the Big House is bigger. Hard to explain it, but it was pretty amazing. So my thanks to Paul Feinbaum. Thanks to Lou Pellegrino for producing this podcast. Last couple podcasts have been Daniel Dale of the Toronto Star. He basically covered the Trump campaign throughout all of 2016. So he was really interesting in sort of in terms of what he saw along the trail and the people he spoke with, and gave you a sense as to why the result was what it was. And Jeff Schwartz, the free agent NFL lineman, played in the league for, I think, 6 or 7 years, now wants to transition to the media. And so that podcast was about just how, as a current player or just recently retired player, how do you make the switch into media? And I thought that was interesting. And Paul Feinbaum, you've just listened to. And obviously, we'll have some more people coming up in the future. Let me thank the guys at Digital Media and my guys at SI.com, including Ben Eagle, Alan Kim, Ryan Hunt, and Bet Marston. Want to thank Mack Weldon as well for sponsoring this podcast. Please go check out Mack Weldon and all their excellent clothing. For Lou Pellegrino, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.